Welcome to episode 6 of Confessions of a Casting Director, where you will hear advice, wisdom, and true stories from inside the audition room. I'm your podcast host, Jen Rudin. I'm so excited for today's guest, the incredibly talented Danny Burstein. Danny is a 6-time Tony nominee and currently starring in the hit Broadway show Moulin Rouge. He has appeared on Broadway 18 times, including My Fair Lady, Fiddler on the Roof, Cabaret, South Pacific, Golden Boy, and The Drowsy Chaperone, to name a few. Some of his many TV and film credits include Boardwalk Empire, Fosse Verdon, Evil, The Blacklist, Madam Secretary, all 3 Law and Orders, and the recent film Indignation. Danny also starred opposite Whoopi Goldberg, Catherine Curtin, and Zoe Coletti in my short film Lucy in the Sky, which just finished its 2019 film festival run. Please welcome Danny Burstein to the podcast. Danny Burstein, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. It's great to be here.
I can't believe I've been wanting to have coffee with you, and we had to make a podcast date in order to catch up.
But it worked out.
We're practically neighbors. It is so good to see you. So,
same here.
Before we talk about your amazing career, 6-time Tony nominee, I do want to say how I met you. So way back 20 years ago.
In the gutter.
I was a casting associate at Susan Shopmaker Casting, and right. We had all this commercial business. This is pre-9/11. And I feel like you were in every single day, first off. You were in all the time. And sometimes you were in, I partnered you with Jackie Hoffman for commercials.
Sure.
But on and on and on. So I don't know if you remember me.
Of course I do.
But I remember you, and those were the days.
Yeah. Is Susan still in business?
She is in business.
God bless her. I just haven't seen her in a long time. That's all. But she was a wonderful casting director.
She is an amazing casting director. And I feel like I know so many New York actors because of those commercial days, because this was also when everything was union. Mm-hmm. Although I did work for her when there was the strike. But you were in all the time.
Yeah.
All the time. And always so nice. We had that huge waiting room.
Yeah.
Where so many stories were going on in that waiting room.
Always.
People reconnecting with each other. And I would pull people off the couch and bring them into the studio.
I sort of miss those times, where older actors would, give you advice and talk to you. And I really learned a lot. And then there were those, of course, the assholes in those actors who knew everything, and you were going against them. You'd see them all the time, and they just felt, you just felt like they had all the confidence in the world, and you didn't have any. Even though I'd auditioned a lot, you just felt like, who are these guys? They just seem to book everything, and I after a while, you just sort of go, you know what? It's for commercials especially, it's about volume.
It is.
And then eventually you sort of hit, and then one thing sort of falls into place, and then the other, and then the next, and the next.
Well, you know what's funny about the commercials? This was the days of the Polaroids.
Yeah.
At the end of the callback session, we would put all of the Polaroids on the table, and the director would sort of start mixing and matching, and some Polaroids would get to the floor, and I'd think, oh God, they just lost, millions of dollars.
Right.
And some Polaroids would stay on, and often the decisions were not just based on what you looked like or matching up a family, but some producer would say, oh, this looks like my ex-husband, and he'd go on the floor. So it was fascinating. Of course, everything has changed now with digital and self-tapes. But I loved those days also because I would bring in these amazing actors and they would be reading Excedrin copy and Sleep Number stores. And I would say, like, I know that you have a master's degree, but this is a national network spot. And
I remember booking a commercial years ago with Barry Herman at Herman Lipson Casting. And he said, after I filmed it, he asked me how it went. And I said, it went great. And he goes, a weird thing happened on that show, on that commercial. He said, the best person who auditioned for it got it. He said, that never happens.
Oh, okay. And that was you.
And it just happened to me. Sometimes you're great and sometimes you suck at the audition. But, I just happened to nail it that particular day. And he said, it just never happens because, they want somebody with black hair instead of brown hair or blonde hair or blue eyes or the decisions are often made like that.
And they chose you.
And I just got lucky that day.
And I booked my big bologna commercial when I was a child actor. First of all, I hate bologna. They made me eat it at the callback. I hate bread. I hate bologna. My father's a rabbi. But we did have bologna in the house. And I made such a face. And I think I booked it because A, I made a face. And B, I was wearing this Oshkosh overall jumper that they made me bring to the shoot. And so I always say to every actor, go on every single commercial audition. Because since we cast the Verizon campaign in Susan's office.
you just never know. Right. But you are from New York City, and so am I. So what neighborhood did you grow up in?
Well, I'm originally from the Bronx, from the West Bronx.
No accent.
No, we lived on Shakespeare Avenue. My family has very thick accents. But then when I was six, we moved to Queens. We moved to Flushing, and my dad got a job teaching at Queens College.
Okay.
And he's still there. He's 83. He's teaching ancient Greek philosophy, and he's still teaching. And then I went to the High School of Performing Arts, and they drummed that thick New York accent out of all of us.
Now, were you in the movie Fame?
I was actually an extra in the movie Fame. They filmed it when I was a freshman, the summer after my freshman year.
Which scenes were you in?
Oh, dancing in the street, running up and down staircases, and that kind of thing. You know.
So I recently rewatched the movie.
Oh, then you saw my arm and my shoulder.
And I have to say, I watched it on two legs of the flight, and my phone remembered where I was. So I loved, I was too young to see the movie. I loved the TV series. And of course, I watched the movie in seventh grade, and we all remember the Coco scene.
Sure.
I have to say, Danny, as a casting director who's always done diversity casting, that movie was so ahead of its time in terms of everything.
Yeah.
The themes, the diversity, every issue was covered. And so while we're in this amazing moment now of diversity casting, and Me Too, and telling all these personal stories that aren't just white stories, that movie told everything. And I am crying on the Alaska Airlines flight, and my husband Andy is watching something silly, but it's still a great movie that everybody should rewatch just to see you as well.
Let's see. Yeah, well, if you could find me.
Did you get paid?
Sure. Yeah.
Wow.
Absolutely. And, you know, because it was my first SAG job, so I didn't have to join SAG.
Great.
And I got paid SAG rates, extra rates, whatever it was. I think it was $79 a day at that particular time.
Good.
But, hey, $79 a day for a
14-year-old. And where did you go to undergrad?
I went to Queens College in New York, where, of course, my dad was, because that was the rule in the house. You went to Queens College because dad was teaching
there.
And
did you study theater?
I did. And I studied with a guy named Ed Greenberg, who was the executive producer at the Muni in St. Louis. And he had opened up Lincoln Center, the musical theater of Lincoln Center, with Richard Rodgers, and was an amazing resource for me and became a great mentor to me. And then when I was 19, he said, they do summer stock in St. Louis. And he said, look, I'd like you to come out and, you know, stay for the season. And I did three shows out there. And my first show out there was The Music Man with Jim Dale and Pam Dauber.
So was she the star because of Mork and Mindy?
Exactly.
And Jim Dale from Barnum.
Exactly right.
So when you were at Performing Arts, were you a drama major or vocal major?
A drama major. They didn't have vocal at Performing Arts. They had that at Music and Art.
Music and Art, that's right. And then the schools combined. And my sister actually, class of 88, was one of the first classes
to graduate
into the new building.
Yeah, right.
So, P.S., I didn't get into music and art, and here's my stupid story. So I, of course, as a professional child actor, I go into my audition to do my monologues, and what do? I hand them my resume picture, and they were just looked at me like, get her out of here. She is so full of herself. And it's one of my shameful secrets that, you know, I was so, you know, pretending it was just another audition, not realizing that they wanted to work and craft and help train actors, not get people like me in who were already jaded.
I knew nothing about the business. I mean, nothing. My mom is a painter and my dad teaches philosophy. And, you know, and it's very kind of small town Queens. And I just loved theater. I loved, my dad gave me books when I was a kid to read. And I just would read about half of them and I'd put them down. And then he had this idea to give me plays. And I immediately got into it. And I loved the dialogue form. I could understand it. I loved people exchanging ideas and working things out. And that started me loving theater. And then I had a teacher in junior high school who said, you know, you should go to the High School of Performing Arts. I said, great, what's the High School of Performing Arts? And he explained it to me. He said, all these incredible people, Liza Minnelli and Ben Vereen, have gone there. And he said, all you have to do is memorize a couple of monologues and go in. And I said, great, what's a monologue? You know, and I had no idea. And the year I auditioned, over 14,000 kids auditioned, New York City school kids, and 127 made it in. And I have no idea how I got in, but I did.
What were your monologues? Do you remember?
I did a monologue from Dead End and another one from The Time of Your Life by William Saroyan.
14,000
yeah.
New York City kids.
Yeah. And it was a really small school at the time, a little over, 400 students. And now they're, of course, at LaGuardia, they're well over 4,000 students.
Wow.
But it was really intense. There were only about 10 people in an acting class. And
are you still friends with some
of
your classmates?
In fact, do you know Keisha Lewis?
Yes, of course.
Keisha was in my class. We've known each other since, we were 15.
I was her manager very briefly.
Were you really?
I left Disney when I was manager, and now she's on Mad About You.
And Erica Gimple and Helen Slater, and there were a lot of wonderful people in my class.
So you're quoted in my book talking about meeting your agent after UC San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
How did you end up at grad school? Was there after college, did you take some time to audition or did you?
I did. Actually, I took a year off. I thought, well, I'm finished with college. I'm going to take the world by storm. And I auditioned and I had all these musical credits on my resume because of the Muni, and Ed Greenberg kept bringing me out to work there. So I had all these, Funny Girl with Juliette Prowse and Larry Kurt and all these wonderful, wonderful credits, but they were all musicals, and I was in the ensemble. And when I was at the High School of Performing Arts, I was going to be the next Marlon Brando. That's what I wanted to do. And I couldn't believe that I couldn't get seen for a play. And nobody wanted to hire me for the other kinds of things that I could do. I felt like I could do anything.
What year is this? Are we in the 80s?
We're at, yes, in 1986.
Okay.
And then so in 87, I started auditioning for grad schools because I took a year off and it wasn't going that well at all. I mean, I auditioned and I had a small agent and it just was not
Were
going
you living
well.
At home still?
I was still living at home, yeah. And with my parents in Queens. And I would commute into the city and run to auditions and get there very early to those equity calls.
Yes,
and
of course.
All those things. Just anything to try and be there, to be a part of the scene. But it just, I just didn't want to only do musicals. So I auditioned for NYU, Yale, Juilliard, and UC San Diego. And UC San Diego accepted me and then offered me a scholarship. So I went.
To
California, which was completely different from, of course, from New York City. It was kind of like being on the moon. It was so, so different.
Did you know how to drive?
Yeah, I did.
You did, because you're from Queens. I'm from Manhattan, so I didn't know.
Yeah, but because my mother, my Costa Rican mother taught me how to drive. She said, I'm not kidding you, for into my teen years, I thought the gas pedal was called the acelerada, because that's the way she spoke with her accent. So I said, okay, here's the brake and the acelerada. So I swear to God, that was my mother, my Costa Rican
mother. So your
mother.
Dad's Jewish and your mom's Costa Rican.
Exactly.
Is that the dynamic?
Yeah, it's New York City. So.
It is. So tell me about California, because I know I have my favorite chapter in Confessions of a Casting Director is my LA versus New York, but you're in San Diego. Are you in La Jolla?
We're in La Jolla. Oh, yeah, exactly.
The most beautiful place
the La Jolla
in the world.
Playhouse is in residence on the UCSD campus. So we got to work with all these wonderful artists that would come in, and they would put us into the shows. We'd audition for the directors, and so it was a lovely time. We had a lot of guest teachers. The original Cirque du Soleil group, we had a teacher from there who came in to teach us clowning. I got a scholarship to study at the Moscow Art Theater while I was there. I studied there for a month and a half, and with a bunch of students from Juilliard and Laura Linney and all these great actors, people who are still friends from that class. And it was an amazing experience. And I came back to New York, and on my way, on the drive back to New York City from San Diego to New York, I got a call from Queens College asking me if I wanted to teach there.
Oh, now that you had a master's degree.
Exactly. And I thought, I was coming back to nothing. I didn't have any money. And I said, yeah, I'll take it for a semester. And I started to teach and I started to audition. And my auditions and I started were plentiful. And then I started to book jobs. And it became, I had to make a decision. Do I go for the teaching, which is what a wonderful thing to do, but I really trained to become an actor, and that's really what I wanted to do.
And you had met your agents at your showcase.
Correct.
I don't know what page it is on the book, but you have a nice paragraph in my book about how you met your agents at the showcase.
Yes. Yeah, it's a terrific. They were it was a terrific agency. It's they're now combined with
Bauman,
Redanti, and Shaw,
right.
BRS.
And you're still with
exactly.
them all these years later.
Yeah, they were I joined them when they were the Gage Group, and it was a wonderful agency with Phil Adelman and Stephen Unger and Wendy
sure.
Adelman, and I loved them, and they treated me like family right from the very beginning.
And did they get that you wanted to do, because you're such an interesting actor to me
yeah.
because of the range of what you do. So Andy and I watch you on Boardwalk Empire, and then the next, or the Fosse Verdon,
mm-hmm.
and then you're in Midsummer Night's Dream, or Fiddler
right.
on the Roof, or Moulin Rouge. And so we're always like, he is, plus you also starred in my movie, Lucy in the Sky, which mm-hmm. we don't have to spend too much time on. We'll talk a little bit about that. But the ability to morph from the serious film TV world to this Midsummer Night's Dream performance that was absolutely amazing and outlandish and hilarious in Central Park,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to do both. So did your agents understand that you could straddle both worlds beautifully?
Well, I just told them from the very beginning that's what I wanted to do. I wanted them to think outside the box. I remember when I was at the High School of Performing Arts, a teacher there said, "Where do you see yourself? What kind of type are you?" And I said, "I can do everything." And he went, "Yeah, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, sure. You know, like, you know, little pisher, who do you think you are?" But that's how I've always seen myself. I want my agents to put me up for roles that they would never think of me for. And I often get into those kinds of auditions where everybody looks exactly the same except for me. And I like the challenge, and I want my talent to take over. And let that be the deciding factor. Years ago, I told Mike, you know, of course, I was pushing Phil Adelman to try send me out for anything that you can think of that is completely different. I want to challenge myself. And he said, okay. And he found this indie film called Nor'easter. And they were looking for a gay, deaf pedophile that worked in a pizza shop in Maine. And I was like, that's me! You know? Of course, I want that desperately. And I worked very hard. And I got it. And then I knew I had the job 2 months in advance, and I studied ASL, and I started, you know, teaching myself, and then I had three different teachers teaching me sign language, and it was amazing, an amazing experience. And of course, we got to go to Maine and film up there in the middle of the winter, which was its own experience.
Delightfully beautiful and warm. Well, it's interesting about the fact that you really can do all the different worlds, because I meet so many actors who say, I want to do voiceover and I want to do film TV. And I always say, you know, we can't be great at everything. And I feel like you are great at everything.
Oh, well, I don't know about
that. But also that it's the skill set that's involved, the difference between doing the 8 shows a week versus showing up on the set at 4 in the morning. Getting into hair and makeup and getting to go from there. So let's talk a little bit about theater before we talk about film and TV.
Okay.
So first of all, I just want to say thank you, because I didn't know you very well, but you were so gracious to show my parents a wonderful backstage tour after they saw you in South Pacific.
Oh, of course.
And then when they went to see Follies, I said to myself, I can't call Danny's agent again and ask him to show the backstage tour. So Laura Lee Geyer offered to do it.
Uh-huh.
And then apparently my parents, you saw them backstage and you're like, Jim, Marsha, I would have showed you around. So thank you for being kind. Drowsy Chaperone is just one of those iconic roles. How on earth did you get involved with that show? Because I still think about your performance. And at the time I was casting The Princess and the Frog,
mm-hmm.
and I was in from LA with my director and producer of that movie, and I took them to see Drowsy, and partially they had wanted to see Sutton Foster, and you were already, I think, coming in for the callbacks, and they were just so blown away by Adolfo. And I feel like your callback for Princess and the Frog was like 4 hours long.
Yeah,
because they kept giving you, throwing more stuff at you. But what a role.
It was a lot of fun. And that was a fluke. And doing that, I'll preface this by saying doing that role put me on the map in many ways. And it happened because Roy Miller, who's a producer who's no longer with us, he had seen me do a reading that I was not supposed to do, and a friend of mine booked a commercial, and it was a role that he played 5 different characters, and each character had a different accent. And so he called me 2 days before the reading, And I said, yeah, sure, I'll help you out. And I did this reading, and Roy Miller was in the audience. And then he called me the next day and said, look, I'm bringing this musical in from Canada. Would you do it? And I was so busy. I was doing so many things at that particular time. And my wife was sitting next to me and could overhear the conversation. And I was about to say no. And she sort of motioned to me, do it, do it, do it. And I said, okay, great. Yeah, I can actually squeeze it in. I can make that work. And I did it. And then one thing led to another. And then Casey Nicholaw took over as director because we didn't have a director at the time. Bob Martin was sort of putting it together. And we did these readings early on at one of the festivals. And it was a big hit. And then Casey came on, and he was an old friend. We were chorus boys together. And then one thing led to another. And it really, for a lot of us, for Beth Level and a lot of the people in the show, we were all old friends.
Right, Jason Kravitz.
Kravitz brothers were in it.
Keisha was in it.
Keisha was in it. And so Casey amassed all these wonderful people that he knew for many years. And it was a love fest from top to bottom. And that was my first Tony nomination. And then all of a sudden, people sort of knew who I was after being in the business for so many years, since I was 19 professionally. And then I was 41 or 42. And then,
see, I love that story. It's such a good teaching moment for actors. Like, it looks like it happened overnight for you, but it was all these years of training and all these years of hard work.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it was really the timing of that role, that flashy role. And the thing about Adolfo is that it could have gone so stereotypical, and
right.
But you were so authentic in it. You were so based in reality that when I see other productions, I was up at Goodspeed watching a production and I was impressed with the Adolfo, but I kept saying to Andy, when we get home, I have to show you, see if I can find a clip on YouTube. And I was playing it for him in the car, and because Danny, it's Danny's role. And I think will always be your role, even though there, I've sure been people that have.
Yeah,
you know,
I think a lot of it has to do with, well, also they fit the roles to us. So everything that we do in the show, you know, we improvised a lot during rehearsals, and they would say, you know, keep that, hold on to that. And it was really a wonderful, organic way to work. And also my, you know, Jewish Hispanic background, you know, it didn't hurt.
It's too much. And then to go into things like South Pacific and Follies, which are right. So sort of more earnest and serious.
Yeah.
The first show that I took my husband to see you in was Cabaret.
Oh.
When we met you backstage.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just absolutely blown away. We saw Snow Geese as well, but mm-hmm. I don't feel we need to talk about that one too. He's like, do you want to tell Danny we're here? And I said, I forgot to tell Danny that we're here. And, you know,
it's no problem.
No offense. And then when we saw you at Midsummer afterwards in Central Park, I could tell that you were exhausted. So the last thing before I really ask you a couple more questions, I want to talk a bit about Fiddler.
Oh, sure.
So when we were in the Cabaret dressing room with you, you whispered in our ear that it was going to be happening. And of course, at the time when Fiddler was in previews, they offered comps to all the rabbis in the tri-state area because they wanted groups of, you know,
group
school kids
sales,
to come in.
Of course.
So between my sister, who's a rabbi, my brother-in-law, who's a rabbi, they had all these comps for the night before the Thanksgiving Day parade. So we all went to see you when the show was like the fourth preview.
Mm-hmm.
And they were still working out some of the sound stuff. And you were so gracious backstage because I knew you all had to get up so early in the morning. They were moving the set out for the parade. And you were so kind
sure.
to my niece as well. So not only are you talented, but you're also a kind person. How do you stay so down to earth and grounded and nice in this crazy business full of egos and all of that? How?
I don't know. I guess I credit my parents, I guess, who are both nice, grounded people. And I guess that's the answer. It's so much easier to be nice. We've all worked with crazy people.
Yes.
And it's so unnecessary. It takes so much energy. And all of a sudden, it's like a whirlwind, and everybody has to pay attention to the whirlwind as opposed to focusing on the work. And I truly believe that when you walk in the door, everybody is your equal. Whether it's the star of the show or the person who is getting you coffee, you're kind to everybody in the room. And then things sort of fall into place because it doesn't become about people's egos or anything like that. It just becomes about the work.
Which is what it's supposed to be.
And it should be every single time. And most of the time it is. But, you know, people are people. And
What's your process for that 8 shows a week? Because I know if I had to do, for me, I'm a morning person. So, like, if my show was at 11 a.m., I'd be great. And then I'm done. I can eat lunch. I can take a nap.
Yeah.
Knowing that at 8 o'clock at night, you have to open up your mouth. And certainly with Mulan, and I know you're going back in the show January 21st.
That's
everybody,
right.
Danny's going back to sing, to dance, to act. Or how do you... When you wake up in the morning, what do you do? I mean, how do you have a day and also know that you have to be at the theater and perform like that?
Yeah, it's not easy. And honestly, I'm 55 now, and it's much harder than it used to be. And in Moulin Rouge, I'm doing can-cans with guys who are 30 years younger than me. And they're going, damn, it's hard, you know? You really have to pace yourself, and your day is sort of dedicated to the show in the evening, or two shows on Wednesdays and Saturdays. It's not an easy thing. You just have to pace yourself. You warm up like crazy. At home. And also when I get to the theater, I'm one of those people who likes to get to the theater early. I'm usually there an hour and a half before the show, warming up. I like to walk around and talk to the stagehands and the stage management team and other actors, and just to feel part of the place and feel grounded in there. And then it's not as scary when you go out. But I think no matter what, I think a healthy amount of a little bit of nerves is a healthy thing.
And when do you eat? Or is every show different? Does every show have its own diet?
It really does. You know, at a certain time that you can eat at some shows you can eat as late as 6 o'clock and you're fine. Other ones you have to eat at like 5 or 5:30. It's so silly, but you have to get into this routine and teach yourself. Your body teaches you what to do.
What kinds of food do you like? I remember when Gavin Lee told me once that he, of course, we were working on Mary Poppins when I worked at Disney, and he had like a piece of like pie before the show for somebody's birthday, and he's doing, we know where he has to step in time,
And
he's climbing up the wall in his tap shoes, and he's hanging upside down, and he said to me, I was so afraid
right.
I was going to like be so sick in the middle of the show, and that's like the best moment in Mary Poppins. So what do you like?
That would have been bad, throwing up from the ceiling.
What do you...
Hanging upside down. Yeah.
What do you eat? I mean, are you doing proteins? And...
I do. Actually, I have like salads, that kind of thing, with some kind of protein on top. And it's silly. I try and vary it a little bit, but some kind of white meat is, or some kind of healthy vegetarian protein. I try not to think too much about it. You know what you can't eat. You can't eat chili, you know, before you go out on stage, because you'll start to, you know,
sweat
and repeat, and it'll repeat on you, and you know that kind of thing. Because you have to jump around. It's very, very active. I'm in PT twice a week at least. During the last weeks before I had my knee surgery, I was in PT 4 times a week just to, you know, get through the shows. It's every show varies. But you just have to listen to what your body is telling you and really take it seriously.
And then what happens, you know, Tim Curtis, a partner at WME, who's a very good friend of mine, who's the animation agent, said we had seen Patrick Swayze and Annie Get Your Gun at the Pantages. Tim used to take me to the theater because he said you're the only casting director in LA who likes to go. So Patrick Swayze, we went to see him, we're backstage, and then we put Patrick in his car, and Tim said the show is not over for an actor until you're in your, for a star, until you're in your car, because you have to go out and you've got to sign those autographs.
Yeah.
So do you have a security person that's always with you?
Yeah, there are always security people from Jujamson outside with us. Yeah.
For most
of the shows, yeah.
To make sure. And then you get into your car and you go home.
Exactly.
And the door of the car closes and you roll up the window.
That's it. And even then, you know, it takes, I'd probably say I'm not asleep for another 2 hours because you're winding down. Your body is so pumped up from the show. I even went to I did a sleep study. And because I was having trouble sleeping, and she even gave me these like UV glasses to wear as soon as I got home or got in the car, you know, that make me look like Bono. But, you know, they block out UV light. So your body starts to learn to slow down, like, and prepare for sleep. there are all these kinds of tricks that actors do. But for me, I usually go home and have a little snack and a beer and watch Rachel Maddow. And
yeah.
That's basically
just like
what
my
I
parents,
do.
So exactly. You can join them in Florida. So, 6-time Tony nominee. And what does that feel like? I mean, I have a feeling it's going to be a 7-time Tony nominee.
Oh, whatever.
This year.
You know what? It's a lovely pat on the back. It really is. But I was not the kid who was, as many of my friends did, practice their Tony or Oscar speech in front of the mirror. That was never me. I just wanted to do good work. And I said to myself when I was starting it, when I was 14, I said, all I want to do is do good work and have the respect of my peers and be able to make a living. That's it. I just wanted the normal things. I wanted to have a home, a family, a car, the normal kind of things that anybody would want. And I've been able to do it. And so the awards that have come my way and the nominations that have come my way are a wonderful pat on the back, but that was never the goal. So when it happens, it's lovely, and I'm not going to turn it down. It's fantastic. But the work every single night is what's exciting to me, and I love it still to this day. I feel the exact same way that I did on my first Broadway show.
That's...
I love the feeling. I love the people. I love the energy. It's so exciting. You're just, there's that old quote, let's go get scared, and I love that feeling, that prep right before you go out.
That's really nice to hear. And I would imagine that the Tony stuff, when you've got Tony voters coming and you've got all the press and the rehearsal, that's an even more taxing time on the body when you're running the show and then you're going over to Radio City and you're doing all the rehearsals.
It's exhausting.
And then it's over.
It is. No doubt about it. It is exhausting, but it's also, thrilling.
And also for everybody in America, that's more ticket sales for all of that and
exactly.
The show getting promoted. Before we talk about some fun, epic audition stories, what do you wish you could tell your younger self knowing what you know today? I mean, it sounds like you were always very practical, down to earth.
Yeah.
You had good parents. I really think it does all begin in the home with the family in terms of keeping everybody calm in this crazy business. But is there any advice you would give to the younger Danny?
Well, you still have that Jewish side, that comes out. I guess I would just say,
what is that Jewish side that comes out?
The Jewish side would, I would tell that Jewish side, what the hell were you so worried about? Just concentrate on doing the work and the rest will fall into place. And just make sure that is your focus all the time. People say, how do I get an agent? How do I meet this one? And I want to, for me, they found me because of the work that I was doing. And also, I was very lucky in many instances.
And what's the Costa Rican side of you say besides accelerating?
I would be late to everything. That's my mom's side of the family. I'm completely late to everything. And we'd cook a lot of food. So I'd be fat and lazy.
Okay.
No, it's not true. They're incredible. That's an incredible side of my family, too. It's a lot of passion.
Let's
and
talk
love.
For just a minute about Fiddler. Did you see the Yiddish Fiddler?
I did. Yeah. It's wonderful.
I
Steve Skibell
wonderful.
Is an old friend, and I thought he was brilliant. I thought the whole production was brilliant. And Joel Grey is also a dear friend of mine, too. And for years, Joel and I have been going out like every month and a half for lunch. He's took me under his wing years ago, and I don't know why, but I couldn't be more grateful. And I thought he's done a masterful job.
It was really, we've seen all the Fiddlers, you know, and we were really very moved. And Andy had just walked his own daughter down the aisle. So we're crying, we're laughing, we're holding each other's hands. For you, when you were preparing to be Tevye, what a, Theodore Baikal, Zero Mostel, Harvey, like all these amazing men have played this role. I mean, what did you do to reinvent Tevye besides the red jacket from that production? Alfred Molina, let's not forget that
yes,
one.
Yes, of course,
the
Fred.
Jew-ish production as Tom Schumacher, our very good friend and my old boss, my former boss called it the Jew-ish version.
For me, I just studied as much as I could about the show. I read every book about Fiddler. I read the source material for the writers. I went and I was in Fiddler. I'd been in it twice in community theater
when
I was a kid. I was in the ensemble the first time in community theater, and then I did it in Summerstock with Theodore Bickel, and I played Mendel, the rabbi's son. And Jay Harnick, Sheldon's brother, directed it, and he was masterful also. He's a wonderful director and wonderful man who's greatly missed. And so I took all those experiences and all that knowledge, and I sort of put it in a backpack, and I kept it on, in a way, and then launched into rehearsals. And I sort of saw him as a walking heart. And Lawrence Luckinbill, who's married to Lucy Arnaz, a wonderful actor, said to me, just approach everything you do as Tevye with an open heart.
Mm.
And that was the best advice I'd got.
Instead of the schmaltz and the this and the and yeah. all that stuff that gets sort
and
of...
I mean, I also credit Bart Scheer for saying right from the very beginning, we're not going for any of that. We're going for the reality of the moment. So it's 1905. It's the Pale of Settlement. This is a dairyman who has five daughters. He works all day, you know, 12, 13, 14 hours a day, and then he goes out and does it again. It is hard, hard work. And so we approached it that way for a long time. And honestly, you know, out of our five-week rehearsal period, the first 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks were like that. And eventually I said to him, you know, it's got to be funny too. we have to play here a little bit because otherwise we're playing the end of the show at the very beginning. So we have to have somewhere to go. And then he lightened up a little. But it was a great way to begin it. And all the lines were born of honesty. And that was a very special way to begin that show.
Andy, after we saw that production, that was the 2015 Thanksgiving time, I think it was 2015. Mm. You know, he comes home and my husband's singing, you know, the songs. And I'm like, all right, you want to tell Danny you can stand by for him? but my husband, Andy, is also one of your biggest fans. And when it was time for my own movie, Lucy in the Sky, we were doing some casting. We already had Kathy Curtin set to be our mom. And we're sitting on the couch and Andy says to me, what about Danny Burstein? He lives close by. He's great. he's no maintenance. He's lovely. And I thought, you know, let me check. So I have to always give him a little. I used to be casting associate credit,
yeah.
But and that was so nice of you to come and spend a few days, you know, doing
of
these
course.
Films.
I had a wonderful time. I thought Bertha was an amazing director.
It's been all over the festivals, and we've had a good run. But we also were so impressed with how you know, you're so chill, and then the cameras go, and you're ready to go, and that ability to kind of conserve the energy on the set. Maybe you could speak a little bit to our listeners about the difference between being on a set where you're waiting around all the time versus the show where you walk in and boom, the show's it starts at 8.
Right, and you run through everything in a linear fashion.
Chronological order.
Exactly. I think you always, when you're on the set, because it's so fractured, you always have to be thinking about the film, the arc of the character, how you want it to go, how you want the character to be at the beginning of the film and the changes that affect him near the end of the film, because sometimes you film the end first. You just never know. And so in all your off time and all your downtime, you should be, even if it's just in the back of your mind, you should be thinking about the work and keeping that focus, because you never know. All of a sudden it's, you know, they're ready for you and you're on. You haven't thought about it for 2 hours. And I just, you know, you can't get caught being lazy.
I think for me as a child actor, I always thought, God, why is it taking so long for them to move the lights? I'm sitting here. It's 4 a.m. at this mall in Kentucky. Can't we just shoot the scene already versus theater where you have a little bit more control of the time? So you're saying even when you're in your trailer or you're, you know, in my office, which was your holding area for our movie, you know, just keeping mellow, keeping your energy intact so that you're ready to go when they're ready for you.
Yeah, and staying focused, keeping your head in the game. I remember years ago reading Michael Caine on film, and his first film, he hadn't really studied the rest of the script. He knew that they were doing two scenes that day and read the rest of the script once. And they turned out that they wanted to do this long scene at the end for him. And they switched everything on him, and they came into his trailer and said, oh, by the way, we're doing this scene instead of the two that, you know, we said we were going to do. And he panicked because he hadn't thought about the rest of the film. And it was a huge lesson to him. So he said from day one, he's always prepared to do any scene at any time and is always focused. And that scared the hell out of me a little bit. And it also made me aware that that could happen.
Yeah, no, that I think that's great of us. We'll be having Michael Caine on in a future episode.
I'm Michael Caine.
In a future episode. Couple more questions and then we will wrap up. What's a dream role that you haven't played yet?
Gosh, I don't know. Willie Loman. But I look forward to doing something that hasn't been written yet or is being written right now. I like knowing what my next job is going to be, of course, and I've been lucky enough to have that luxury for years now. And whatever it is, I want it to just blow my skirt up, you know? I want it to be something exciting that that I can really sink my teeth into, and that's different. So whatever it is, I want to be excited about it.
That makes sense. So 18 Broadway shows?
18 Broadway shows.
We forgot to mention My Fair Lady. We're mentioning it now. Oh. 18 Broadway shows,
yeah.
Lots of movies, tons of Law and Orders, as we know, from when they played that wonderful clip of you.
Yeah.
Let's just dig in a moment to some epic audition stories. We had them sprinkled throughout my book, and my editor at HarperCollins was like on the floor laughing because I'd gathered so many from different actors. What is like the craziest, the worst audition?
When I was a kid, I auditioned for A Little Shop of Horrors in Galveston, Texas. And I
for
walked
the dentist or for
for Seymour.
For Seymour.
And I was the first audition of the day, and I started my song, and the guy was, it was just him behind the desk and the accompanist. And I started my song, and he started looking down immediately at his desk and looking back and forth, you know, like he was confused. As it was singing, he looked up at me one more time and then kept looking around his desk and then stood up and walked across the room in the middle of my song. I'm still singing. He really hadn't listened to anything I was doing and went to the trash can in the corner and started rifling through the trash in the middle of my song. And I looked over at the accompanist and he just sort of shrugged and went, I don't know. So, and then he walked back, shaking his head, to sit back behind his desk, and I finished my song, and he said, well, I don't know where their callback sheet is, but you've got a callback.
That's great. That is a happy ending.
I was like, oh, thank God.
Because I thought he was looking for his, like, lunch.
Who knows? Exactly.
Driver's license.
I didn't know. It was the weirdest thing. You know, rifling through the garbage, you know, as I'm trying to sing forward, you know, that was the strangest thing.
That is great. Well, that one's a good one.
Yeah.
That's hilarious because, you know, people are so distracted now. You know, I always say to an actor, I'm so sorry I'm nibbling my lunch in the middle of your audition. It's just been a hectic day. And it's even worse now with everybody with their phones. One of our mutual friends, actually, and I won't name his name, like walked out of an audition, like a TV audition, because everybody was eating and because they were looking at his phones. And he said, you know what, guys, I'm good. I'm good. And the casting director ran after him and said, no, stay, stay, stay. And he went, no, I came all the way here to Brooklyn, to the Navy Yard or whatever, for this producer session. And he was just so over it. So I'm very aware of trying not to be multitasking.
Well, he hadn't done dinner theater then, I guess.
I was going to say, but I love, that's the best story. So what's the best one where you went, that was good, good.
The best audition stories I've had some good ones that are the ones where you walk in the room and you own the room. You know that it's your 2.5 minutes or whatever it is in the room, and you feel like you're going to teach them how to do this role correctly. And I used to get nervous, and then I started thinking of them as kids. And I'd taught some theater when I was younger, and so I was just thinking about them as kids, and I would walk in the room, and I would teach them how to do the role correctly. And if I wanted the chair that was set up left of me, if I wanted it to the right of me, I'd put it there. If I wanted to get up and touch the reader's face, I would do that, or kneel at the reader's feet. Whatever it was, I owned that room for 2.5 minutes, and I was going to do my audition the way I wanted it, no matter what. Then after you walk out the door, whatever happens, happens. You know, it could be something as stupid as, you know, they wanted a blonde guy for that, or they wanted someone with hair,
right,
you know, which I'm losing very quickly. You know, you never know. But if you feel like you own the room when you walk in there, as opposed to wasting time, oh, God, I'm so nervous, you know, before you walk in there and your heart's beating like crazy. Instead of doing that, if you just walked in the room going, I'm going to teach these people how to do the role correctly, and they're going to love it. You know,
I think that's great. And then, it also lets you have some control over the situation.
Exactly.
As our friend Jason Kravitz said, you know, actors just want to act. And so I was thinking, if you can use that opportunity, every audition is an opportunity to do some acting. And then, as I say, get on with your life.
Exactly.
Go have lunch, call your mother, do whatever you need to do.
Exactly.
Well, this has been so fun. You are very active on social media. So if where can people find you? And you're very political, I might say.
I am on Instagram, sure. I am. It's Danny Burr. Danny Burr at
you're very political. I try to be more about book stuff and all that,
right.
But I give you a lot of credit because I always know what's going on in the world and what I should be enraged
yeah,
about.
You know, you have to, at this point, it's just insane what's going on in our country, and I think you have to speak out.
Well, let's hope for a peaceful new decade, especially as we go into 2020.
Here.
And a happy new knee for you, or a repaired knee. And your Danny Burstein is back in the show on January 21st. I went for my birthday and in October, smiled for the entire time, was blown away. Sets and what Danny is doing, stealing the show. It's just too much because we know you.
Right.
Andy and I kept looking at each other going, oh, God. Oh,
yeah.
Danny. Oh,
there
Danny.
He goes
there
again.
He's having the time of his life. So thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Jen. I had a great time.
Oh, my gosh. That is Danny Burstein. He is truly one of the most gifted, funny, and kind human beings in this world. And Danny is back starring in Moulin Rouge as of January 21st. So go see him in this fabulous show doing the can-can. You can also follow Danny on Instagram at Danny Burr. New episodes of Confessions of a Casting Director drop every other Tuesday. And if you love this podcast as much as I love doing it, please subscribe, rate, and review the show in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We would also love for you to contribute too. Your contributions help us make more episodes, and no amount is too small. Visit jenrudencasting.com/podcast to contribute today. Thanks for listening.